Have you ever felt overwhelmed by the sheer volume of stuff in your home? You're not alone. Americans are facing a weight crisis, not of bodies, but of possessions. Most of us have accumulated far more than we can effectively manage, creating stress and chaos in our living spaces. This phenomenon has become so widespread that professional organizers Judy Culbertson and Marge Decker have built careers helping clients ranging from the frantically embarrassed to those unwilling to part with even a bent hanger. Their book, Scaling Down, has become a cult favorite among minimalists and organization enthusiasts, with celebrities like Marie Kondo and the Home Edit team citing it as an influence on their own methodologies. The book's enduring popularity speaks to a universal truth. Our relationship with our possessions is complex, emotional, and often problematic. But there's hope. By understanding why we accumulate and learning strategies to let go, we can create homes filled only with what we truly love and use, spaces that offer control, freedom, and a sense of peace. Our complicated relationship with possessions has deep historical roots. Depression-era parents kept everything with good in it, from rubber bands to soy sauce packets, passing these habits to their children. Post-war Americans were encouraged to buy, buy, buy as patriotic spending, while manufacturing became so cheap that replacing items was easier than finding them. The Reagan years glorified visible consumption, shifting our comparison targets from neighbors to millionaires. Most people spend their first 40 years enthusiastically accumulating, and the next 40 trying to shed the excess. We start with little, gratefully accept hand-me-downs, then shop until we're buried alive in possessions that consume our time just managing them. Even those who don't identify with conspicuous consumption likely find themselves swimming in excess stuff. Young adults begin with term papers and stuffed animals, quickly acquiring cast-offs from family and friends. Weddings bring duplicate gifts we didn't know existed. Credit cards make it easy to buy everything at once until we realize we're spending too much time managing possessions rather than enjoying life. Sometimes a wake-up call comes earlier. Judy had her epiphany during a beach vacation where the rental house contained only essentials, allowing the family to relax instead of managing possessions. For the first time, she knew exactly where everything was and came home determined to maintain that vacation house feeling. Unlike Marge, who organized her aunt's cupboards at age 9 and whose frequent moves prevented accumulation, Judy was a disaster, an artist with materials everywhere, a collector of memorabilia and injured furniture, married to a hoarder of magazines and gadgets. Her mother's professional shopping habits inundated the family with clothing and antiques. Though she eventually achieved that vacation house feeling, it took years to unlearn ingrained habits. What makes scaling down difficult are our blind spots, areas of sticky clutter that derail the entire project. These include replaced but kept electronics, just in case, unwanted gifts displayed out of obligation, harmless duplicates like multiple umbrellas, professional materials from former careers, free items that make us feel advantaged, painful but new-looking shoes, incomplete collections we've lost interest in, unused equipment we hope to use someday, unread magazines kept for the good stuff, and others' belongings we're storing. Our culture perpetuates the myth that more is better, from restaurant portions to housing. This mentality assumes downsizing means failure, yet this attitude is facing resistance. The more grounded you become, the less you'll care about being judged by possessions rather than personality and achievements. Scaling down doesn't mean abandoning your style. It actually heightens focus on what you truly love while stripping away what no longer fits or complicates your life. When told the simple solution to clutter was discarding half of everything they owned, workshop participants reacted as if asked to murder a pet. People's relationships with possessions are complex, making quick fixes impossible. Though there's no magic bullet for decluttering, once you acknowledge your ambivalence, create a mission statement, and begin the process, you'll experience increasing relief through catharsis and regained control. Unlike the fear of flying, scaling down comes with 21 distinct fears. People worry they'll discard items they might need later, though if you haven't used something in 5 years, odds are you never will, or that they'll lose social acceptance by downsizing, though true friends relate to you, not your possessions. Many fear revisiting painful memories in old keepsakes, though going through emotional items with a supportive person can bring catharsis, or worry they'll start but not finish, which is why a clear mission statement is crucial. The paralysis of facing overwhelming clutter can be overcome by starting anywhere, working when you're energized, and tackling visible areas first. Some resist letting go because they believe their belongings define them, or fear they'll be left with mediocre possessions. Others use their partner's clutter as an excuse not to address their own, or worry they're disrespecting family history by discarding inherited items. The key is recognizing that your identity isn't in your stuff, and that opening physical space invites new experiences. Creating a scaling-down mission statement helps crystallize your purpose and provides direction when feeling overwhelmed. Effective statements follow the "I need to, so I will" format. For those facing resistance, acknowledging your buts helps identify emotional barriers. Address these objections by finding support, setting realistic timeframes, or seeking professional help. Your mission statement becomes your anchor throughout the process. Visual aids powerfully support your decluttering goals. Tape up magazine photos of your ideal space, or create mental images of what you want to achieve. Focus on these visions before sleep or upon waking to program your subconscious toward making them reality. Remember, action comes before motivation. For tasks like organizing that seem overwhelming, set a 15-minute timer and begin. Once started, you'll likely find yourself motivated to continue beyond the timer's buzz, both surprised by your progress and newfound enthusiasm. We accumulate items for complex emotional reasons, often tied to relationships and identity. Consider these common culprits that fill our homes with unnecessary items. Artists accumulate a lifetime of creative work that feels impossible to discard, since each piece represents a part of themselves. The solution? Set aside time to review everything objectively, keeping only your best pieces while photographing others as a space-saving record. Consider selling work at affordable prices at art fairs or inviting friends to select pieces they'd like, preferring your work go to people who will enjoy it rather than sitting in storage. We all accumulate items from abandoned hobbies and fleeting enthusiasms, language tapes for trips abroad, craft supplies purchased in bursts of inspiration, exercise equipment bought with good intentions. These purchases sit unused, generating guilt rather than joy. Despite telling ourselves we'll return to them when we have more time, that time rarely materializes. Even retirees report being busier than ever. The truth is, if you don't develop the habit when enthusiasm is highest, you likely never will. National Geographic created the myth that certain magazines are too beautiful to discard, despite having little resale value unless pre-1930s. Their cousins, art calendars, and specialty publications pile up year after year as we convince ourselves we'll frame the images someday. Remember that calendars were designed to be time-limited. If necessary, razor out one or two treasured images and donate the rest to teachers for classroom displays. Unlike consumable hostess gifts like flowers or wine, many presents, exotic condiments, liqueurs, decorative items, accumulate because discarding them feels ungrateful. These well-intentioned tokens of appreciation become clutter that lingers far beyond their welcome. Few items generate more guilt than lovingly crafted gifts we dislike. Aunt Winnie's garish afghan, a friend's macrame plant hanger, children's lumpy clay creations. Remember, once given, a gift is yours to use as you please. Consider hosting an unwanted gift party where friends exchange their least liked presents, often finding that one person's reject becomes another's treasure. Taking photos of gifts with their givers creates a record while allowing you to pass items along to places they'll be appreciated. The key is separating the physical object from your relationship with the giver. Paper clutter can be dangerous, physically and mentally. The Collier brothers died when Langley triggered one of his booby traps, causing newspapers to fall and kill him. Beyond such extreme cases, paper piles create stress when we frantically search for important documents buried somewhere in the mess. Our complicated relationship with paper stems from excessive respect for printed words, fear of missing crucial information, taking junk mail personally, and not trusting our memories. Our attachment to paper stems from childhood respect for printed words in textbooks. We fear discarding unread materials might mean missing crucial information, perhaps even the secret of living forever buried on page 43. But in today's information age, significant findings are repeated endlessly across media channels and easily found online. We also take mailings too personally, imagining someone worked hard to prepare information specifically for us, when most are simply mass-produced. Even attractive glossy magazines and charity calendars must be evaluated based on usefulness, not visual appeal. Finally, we don't trust our memories, hoarding playbills and greeting cards to maintain a factual record of our lives. For paper problems, gather every piece from throughout your home into one massive pile: envelopes, flyers, newspapers, magazines, catalogs, junk mail. While jokingly suggesting "then burn them" isn't practical advice, consolidating scattered paper nests serves two purposes. It instantly tidies the rest of your home and keeps papers in one place for methodical sorting. Start by quickly pulling out recyclables like flyers and newspapers, then separate catalogs, magazines, and photographs into distinct piles. Begin with practical papers: sales receipts, pay stubs, bills, tax materials, instructions, warranties, addresses, and medical records, as many need saving. Quickly discard paid bills, past event invitations, expired coupons, ATM receipts, and receipts for everyday purchases like food and clothing you're already wearing. Keep current bills, rebates, charity appeals, and health forms in a drawer with envelopes and stamps. File large purchase receipts with warranties, put return receipts with car keys, and tax-related receipts in a current taxes folder. Create a pending folder for unresolved matters. For aspirational materials like gourmet recipes, decorating magazines, and travel brochures, create a hope chest, a sturdy box, not a filing cabinet, where you store only projects that genuinely excite you. Remove articles from magazines, place them in clear plastic sleeves, and discard the rest. Keep only one box and periodically purge outdated ideas. For sentimental items like birthday cards, children's artwork, and memorabilia, sort into categories, but don't simply toss everything into a memorabilia box without discrimination. Even the most sentimental people can learn to distinguish between truly meaningful items and knee-jerk emotional responses. Save only cards with warm personal messages or that still make you laugh. Don't feel compelled to keep everything for historical accuracy. The truth police won't come knocking. Collections often begin innocently, an attraction to cows, old screwdrivers, or commemorative items, but can quickly grow beyond control as friends and family contribute to your perceived interest. Soon, casual acquaintances leave frogs or beer cans on your doorstep, and what began as a simple pleasure becomes overwhelming. Understanding why we collect helps address the challenge of scaling down. People collect for many reasons. The thrill of the hunt, finding a prized item delivers the same excitement as a successful hunt. The need for completion. Manufacturers deliberately create collectible series with accessory pieces. A purpose in life. Collections give everyday life a specific focus beyond routine activities. Sociability. Sharing experiences with like-minded collectors creates community. Investment potential, though most collections are just stuff that will only marginally appreciate. Childhood carryovers. Many collecting habits originate in childhood hobbies encouraged by parents. Emotional fulfillment. Collections sometimes fill emotional voids or recreate happy memories. Or unconscious habit. Some collecting happens without awareness, as with the homeowner who had over 100 duck-themed items but was genuinely surprised when they were pointed out. When scaling down or moving to smaller spaces, collectors face five common dilemmas: unwanted gifts continuing to arrive despite lost interest, uncertainty about what to do with no longer loved collections that have grown too large despite continued interest, uncertainty about which items might be valuable, and the collector's temperament that won't simply disappear. Scaling down a collection begins with scaling down how you think about what you possess. The better collector first ensures they're still in love with their items. If your collection disappeared, would you be devastated or merely regretful? Sometimes it's time to say goodbye, as Joan did with her antique Valentines, selling them on eBay and keeping only favorites. You can choose representative pieces rather than keeping everything, like Vicky, who kept just her son's most meaningful stuffed animal. Consider collecting intangibles, like the Travel Century Club members who track countries visited, or birdwatchers with their life lists. Photographs of architecture, grave monuments, or manhole covers take far less space than physical objects. Collecting smaller items, napkin rings, wine labels, or museum postcards can satisfy the collecting urge without overwhelming your space. Last year, Dorothy moved from the East Coast to her daughter's California home, bringing her extensive 16-foot wardrobe that now hangs in her son-in-law's basement office. "It's not as if her clothes are that good," her daughter confided. "Lots of faded skirts and blouses, and suits. All you need where we are is a couple of pairs of shorts." Our relationship with clothing began at birth, when we were dressed up, photographed, and told how cute we looked. As toddlers, we formed attachments to colors and patterns and learned that new clothes were supposed to be exciting. By junior high, most girls became intensely clothes-conscious, comparing themselves to peers and magazine images. Yet this focus didn't teach us how to dress or shop effectively as adults. We were too busy copying trends, rebelling against parental choices, and trying different identities. The messages we absorbed from our families still influence our clothing choices today. Wait until it goes on sale. A special occasion calls for a new outfit. You can never go wrong with Navy. Always buy good quality. People can tell. These reactions to clothing are like tics, innate reflexes we're barely aware of. When we haven't made peace with these voices from our past, we accumulate physical evidence. Many of us were never taught how to dress or buy clothes. Fashion magazines show expensive, cutting-edge outfits impractical for everyday life, while department stores offer racks of styles that don't consider our individual needs. The result? Closets full of not-quite-right clothing, not bad enough to discard, but not good enough to wear happily. Understanding the cultural and emotional biases that keep us overloaded and underdressed is the first step to scaling down. Emotional ambivalence makes us feel guilty about focusing on clothes, believing there are more worthwhile pursuits. This mindset leads to hasty purchases that join the not-quite-right items already hanging in our closets. Scaling down your wardrobe requires understanding the meaning clothes have for you while deciding on a better direction. The process begins by gathering supplies: black trash bags, cardboard cartons, post-it notes, and a pen. Start by clearing everything that's not on hangers or shelves from your closet. Then select three outfits you like, that fit, and that you wear regularly. Everyone should have three outfits per season they could pack for an unexpected trip with 5 minutes' notice. Choose a personal mantra to repeat during the process, like, "Almost right clothing will never be right," or, "When I get rid of these unwearable clothes, I will feel really free." This mantra will help drown out contrary voices telling you to keep everything just in case. Work with clothes while they're hanging in the closet, removing items you hate, gifts with subtext, and clothes that are too small, faded, or stained. Consider how you want to appear to the world: elegant, stable, creative, then remove anything that doesn't support this image. Finding appropriate new homes for possessions you no longer need brings satisfaction beyond simply discarding them. Jeff's story of carefully finding the right charity for his beloved van illustrates the importance of ensuring items go where they'll be truly appreciated. The process takes time and ingenuity, but prevents contributing unnecessarily to landfills and provides emotional closure when parting with meaningful possessions. When downsizing, four primary options exist for rehoming possessions: giving to family and friends, selling through various venues, donating to charitable organizations, or recycling/trashing appropriately. Unlike traditional inheritance, where possessions are bequeathed after death, many people now prefer distributing meaningful items during their lifetime to enjoy seeing recipients' reactions. This approach requires navigating potentially complex family dynamics, such as children with vastly different living situations and interest levels in family heirlooms. A common obstacle when giving away possessions is the fear that recipients won't properly care for cherished items. The essential realization is that once given, we must release control over possessions. What matters most isn't the preservation of objects, but the joy they bring to those who receive them. The landscape for selling possessions has transformed dramatically in recent years. Traditional antique dealers now compete with online auctions like eBay and face inflated expectations from shows like Antiques Roadshow. While dealers still buy silver, china, furniture, and collectibles, sellers have many more options, including consignment shops and professionally managed tag sales. Reputable dealers are legally bound to offer fair prices, though sellers should remember that dealers know market values and have business expenses. Donating usable items provides the satisfaction of knowing they'll continue to be appreciated while improving someone else's quality of life. Before donating books, cull outdated materials like old medical texts, science books, condensed books, and damaged paperbacks. Good donation venues include library book sales, daycare centers and schools for children's books, senior centers and assisted living facilities, and national organizations like Books for Africa and Books for America. Donate clothing to charities with retail stores like Salvation Army, Goodwill, and Vietnam Veterans. For vintage items, consider high school drama departments or theater groups. Professional clothing can benefit Dresker Success programs, helping lower-income job applicants. When donating, avoid the large pink bins in shopping centers, as these items are often sold by the pound for recycling rather than given directly to those in need. Our shopping-obsessed culture has created environments where shopping malls outnumber high schools and receive more weekly visitors than churches. While many deny being recreational shoppers, shopping provides purpose in daily life. The chapter examines compulsive shopping behaviors, like those of affluent women struggling to organize their many returns, and how shopping creates social bonds. People naturally gravitate toward others with similar interests, and shopping has become one such shared activity. Shopping buddies plan vacations around retail opportunities, take bus trips to outlet towns, and bond over showing each other their purchases. While predominantly women join these social shopping groups, male shopaholics typically shop alone. Recreational shopping isn't inherently wrong, but requires discipline to avoid accumulating clutter, especially for those committed to living in smaller spaces. The authors suggest avoiding all shopping venues for a month, including malls, garage sales, discount warehouses, and online platforms. This radical proposal typically elicits nervous laughter, but has several compelling justifications. The fundamental principle, exposure creates desire, explains how browsing leads to unplanned purchases. Simply seeing items, whether bargains, new gadgets, or beautiful objects, creates instant desire for things we didn't know existed hours earlier. Retail environments are deliberately engineered to maximize purchases. Store layouts, product positioning, and packaging are meticulously designed to trigger emotional responses. Even supermarkets place necessities like milk in far corners to force shoppers past tempting displays. Warehouse stores omit express checkout lanes and aisle markers to encourage browsing and larger purchases. Shopping fulfills psychological needs beyond simple acquisition of goods, serving as therapy, social connection, and identity formation. For people like Lori, who turns to late-night shopping channels after a relationship breakup, shopping provides emotional comfort. The anticipation and arrival of packages creates the feeling of receiving gifts, filling emotional voids, and rebuilding damaged self-esteem. Many use shopping as a mood enhancer during periods of restlessness or discontent, seeking distraction or a new self-image through purchases rather than addressing underlying feelings. A healthier approach is refinement shopping, thoughtfully replacing items to create a more harmonious living space with only things you love or need. This might mean trading scratchy bath towels for fewer but fluffier ones, or replacing a heavy vacuum with a lighter, more maneuverable model. Even this can become problematic if perfectionism takes over, but the key difference is improving your own life rather than impressing others. When things are just right, you can simply stop. Our society has developed an obsession with size and newness that affects how we view our living spaces. Even first-time homebuyers now reject perfectly functional bathrooms and kitchens as small or dated. This conditioned mindset leads people to demand oversized master bedrooms, chef-worthy kitchens they rarely use, and multiple car garages. The obsession with bigness has infiltrated our living spaces, trickling down from the wealthy to those with modest means. Advertising reinforces the connection between size and status. A state-of-the-art kitchen or four-car garage signals success. Even those uninterested in impressing others find reassurance in spacious surroundings, perhaps unconsciously rebelling against historical European restrictions where only nobility could display certain luxuries. Living in a smaller space means swimming against cultural currents that equate size with success. When someone calls your house cute or little, it can feel like an insult, implying you couldn't afford something larger. Despite these societal pressures, it's important to remember that people are remembered for their contributions, not their closet space. Mother Teresa, Jesus Christ, Benjamin Franklin, and the Beatles are remembered for what they gave the world, not their living arrangements. Great art and ideas have traditionally emerged from urban areas where people live in smaller spaces. Psychologically, people respond better to smaller, cozier spaces, seeking out alcoves and corners rather than large, high-ceilinged rooms. This human-scale preference traces back to childhood pleasures of forts and small personal spaces. The relaxation we feel in vacation homes comes partly from having fewer possessions to manage and easily locatable essentials. At home, we accumulate multiples of everything, like four potato peelers when one would suffice. This multiplication of possessions creates heaviness and stress. When items have designated places and exist in manageable numbers, finding them becomes effortless and putting them away becomes routine. Living with fewer possessions in a smaller space frees both physical and emotional energy. When everything has its place, you spend less time searching and cleaning. This liberation allows more energy for entertaining, travel, and new experiences. Bob Reed exemplified this freedom, living most of his adult life in a hotel room while working as an actuary into his 90s, attending cultural events, traveling to visit family, and walking miles through New York City daily, living fully without being burdened by possessions. Smaller spaces force intentional choices about possessions. As Adelaide Altman notes in Elder House, "You have no space now to house mediocrity." Many discover that items they couldn't imagine living without often remain untouched for months. Interestingly, a smaller home with customized details can cost the same as a larger, generic space. Thoughtful design in a smaller footprint creates more comfort than raw square footage. The lighter you live and the less encumbered you are, the easier it becomes to move forward into new adventures. Barbara Sher's book, It's Only Too Late If You Don't Start Now, explains how maturity actually makes it easier to explore passions and dreams. You need to meet these dreams halfway, rather than staying in the same large home for decades, sticking to old routines until you're forced into a more restricted situation unprepared. By scaling down, you can focus on a thrilling new life by letting go of stuff, the pride of large, and preconceived ideas about age limitations.